This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Police departments can be racially biased and overly violent. That has been found over and over across America by the U.S. Justice Department. They put Seattle under a court order for a pattern of excessive force and evidence of racial bias. Under a federal watch, the Seattle Police Department has been training its officers in how to de-escalate a volatile situation, how to recognize and account for their own implicit biases. Seattle hired a new police chief. President Obama called the SPD a success story for that process. Well, President Trump is backing off that kind of action. His U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, says the Department of Justice should make sure officers follow the law.
But we need, so far as we can, in my view, help police departments get better, not diminish their effectiveness. And I'm afraid we've done some of that. So we're going to try to pull back on this. And I don't think it's wrong or mean or insensitive to civil rights or human rights. I think it's out of a concern to make the lives of people, in particular the poor communities, minority communities, live a safer, happier life.
Sessions suggested that all this federal scrutiny has undermined respect for police and made police less effective. Our next guest sees it differently. MSNBC host Chris Hayes has written the new book, A Colony in a Nation. Chris, welcome to KUOW.
Great to be here.
A Colony in a Nation. You are comparing policing in some cities to British rule over the American colonies. First of all, are you talking about Seattle? You just heard about our consent decree.
Yeah, I think, you know, from what I know about Seattle, I think there's been some improvements here, marked ones, and there's a variety of departments across the country in which there's been improvements. In some ways, part of the point of the book, though, is that the system that underlies policing itself produces so many of the excesses, right? So we can focus on particular instances of egregious violence, egregious misconduct. We can widen out a little bit to patterns and practices of individual police departments, which are some are worse than others. Let's be clear.
Ferguson jumps to mind,
right.
Baltimore.
Exactly. But what the book's trying to do in a sort of holistic fashion is to say, look, there's an entire system that's been constructed that actually has tremendous similarities from city to city and even town to town. Why did we build that system, and what does it do?
Yes, this is, as I say, a colony in a nation. Police are trying to not to protect and serve, but we think of a colony, you know, the idea is to oppress and exploit. So you said it yourself. Why? Why would public police departments do that?
In places like Ferguson, where I think the metaphor first came into my head and seemed most acute, if you read that DOJ report, it's very clear the police department there really does exist to extract revenue from the majority black residents of that municipality.
Tickets and fines.
More than protect the public safety. I mean, it is fundamentally a sort of extractive undertaking, and an extractive undertaking in precisely a similar way to the British Crown during the American colonies. Other places like other large cities, Baltimore and Chicago, that kind of extractive revenue aspect I think is less present. But what is present is the idea of containing disorder to certain precincts and quadrants so as to preserve some sanctity and security and safety in the other quadrants. And that elemental desire for that, which I think is the driving force behind the construction of the world's largest prison system, is remarkably powerful, remarkably enduring, and remarkably applicable across a whole bunch of different regions and areas of the country.
Well, how would Americans never not want to be privileged to be separated from crime?
Right. So there's some level at which the basic impulse is a universal one.
Yeah.
No one wants
elemental. You said
elemental. Yeah. No one wants to be the victim of crime. No one wants to have people involved in the criminal justice system around them. Right. I like to say that the ideal number of interactions to have with the police is zero.
Yeah.
And that's true for everyone, right?
That's your goal.
You don't want to be the victim of crime. You don't want anyone you love to be a victim of crime. You don't want to be suspected of committing a crime. And you don't want anyone you love to be suspected of committing a crime. And in huge parts of the country, even in a city that has, you know, different neighborhoods, right? That's basically what happens, right? I mean, I would imagine, speaking to you, that you're not interacting with the police a ton from day to day. That's also true of me. And thank God for it, right? That's true of certain precincts of this country. But in other ones, interaction with the police is a constant. It's a constant intrusion. And Judge Shira Scheinlein's opinion in the district court in New York City striking down stop and frisk, she just talks about the numbers, the routineness of being a man of young man of color in certain New York City neighborhoods where several times a week you were going to be stopped at random, searched, and humiliated. That kind of interruption is fundamentally in tension with some of our most basic constitutional democratic commitments. And importantly, it's not clear, in fact, to me, I think the data shows it overwhelmingly, is actually preventing crime.
You bring up race, which is central, and you write about how central this is to this colonization within America.
Yeah, I think in so many ways, the experience of what I call in the book white fear is foundational. The first diary entry of the captain of the ship that lands at Jamestown is we were set upon by the savages.
Yes.
The entire enterprise of the sort of settler colonial state that we erected, the enterprise of the slave South, was one of racialized conflict and conquest. And even amidst the conquest, fear of rebellion. Right. So even if when you've won the spot on the frontier, when you've cleared the settlement at Plymouth, when you have the plantation under your control, there beckons always in the back of your mind the fear that it could be taken back over. And that fear, I think, is one of our most profound forces of cultural inheritance. It's woven into our DNA.
But that stuff was a long time ago. I know because I see in history books and it's just engravings and drawings. It's not videos. That's old news.
Right. But of course, you know, we see the continuity of that kind of fear. We saw it.
I say with irony, by the way.
Yes, I know that. And I grew up in New York City in the 1980s and 90s. I grew up in the Bronx. I grew up in the city in a year. You know, I started going down to Manhattan to go to a public school in 1991 when there were about 2,300 murders. Last year, there were 350. Gives you a sense of what the temperature was like.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea. Here I was, a relatively privileged kid. I was going to a good school, and I was a white kid in the city. And every second of the day that I walked around that city, that same ember burned in my head that around the corner lurked the danger of the other, and that the security I had was conditional and tentative. And that idea was so powerful that it led to the election of Rudy Giuliani and the inauguration of Broken Windows and a lot of white liberals in New York City voting for him as recently as, you know, 20 years ago, because that same idea, the same kernel of that idea that there's some sanctity that we can carve out if only we can sufficiently suppress, barricade against, and contain the wild forces of the dark other.
Broken windows policing you're referring to, meaning a lot of interactions with police in order to keep things under control.
Particularly cleanse the city of disorder. And this is, I think, a key concept to understand. You know, we have the term law and order. It's Richard Nixon deployed it. The president of the United States at his own convention speech said, "I am the law and order president." It's something that he has talked about a lot. And I used to think of that term, the force of the term lay in the first word, law, but have come to realize that it's really about order. And order is a more amorphous and ambiguous concept than the law. Order is in the eye of the beholder. Order is a conception of whether things are in their place. And in 1982, there's an article published in The Atlantic by Kellingham Wilson that about broken windows that basically makes the argument that if you have disorder, if you have broken windows, say, in a building or a car in a neighborhood, you will soon get more disorder and more broken windows, which will lead to lawlessness and disintegration because the message will be sent that no one is caring for this place. And so they urge a return among police to the earlier practice of not focusing on the law so much, but order maintenance. And that's adopted by William Bratton, who at the time is the head of the subway system's police unit. He then becomes the head of—
In New York City.
In New York City. He becomes the head of police. It is one. It is the dominant paradigm for policing across the country. And what it requires is getting rid of squeegee men who wash your car, people that sell M&Ms on the subway get a ticket and a summons.
Loose cigarettes
like Eric Garner, the man who was choked to death by the NYPD. All of that is under this rubric of preserving the certain kind of order.
The book is A Colony in a Nation by Chris Hayes, and I wonder who the book is for, because you know that many people, many Republicans particularly, don't agree with you, and they're not all racism deniers, but they see law-abiding African-Americans having it rougher than they deserve and law-breaking people of all races who deserve what they get. So how are you documenting anything different? Who are you convincing?
You know, one thing I've learned as a writer and also as a broadcaster is you cannot control the reception of your words, right? Mm. What you try to do is you try to write for as broad an audience as possible, and you try to make arguments that maybe sort of find their way to kind of sidewind around people's defenses and ideological postures. And one of the projects of this book is very explicitly to do that, to get people to take the context of the criminal justice system and policing and race and take a bunch of those elements and shake the context and put them in new places. So when I talk about our own revolutionary generation, the forefathers, and their anger at the police and police harassment, when I talk about the way a campus justice system works, which is its own kind of justice system, what I'm trying to do is to get people to see the basic structures and elements of something that is familiar in a kind of rote way in new contexts, so they can sort of come to some new conclusions about fundamentally, empathetically, if they had to put themselves in the shoes of the folks on the other side of this divide, how they would feel.
Well, you put yourself in it, Chris. There's a point where you call the police and regret it, or maybe regret it?
Yeah. The book opens with just talking about calling the police because a couple's having an argument. And it's more than that. It's a man screaming at a woman in a way that I felt was violent and threatening and intimidating. And I call the cops, and the cop shows up. They get out of their car. And ultimately, the man and woman get their car and go off, and the whole thing is done. And I think to myself, well, you know, I did my job. But the more reporting I did on policing and the system, the more I thought, like, who did I do that for? I want to think I did it for her, to protect her, but did I protect her? Because all that happened was then she got in the car with him, and maybe he was even angrier that someone had called the cops, and he took it out on her. Or did I do it fundamentally for me, because I didn't want someone yelling in the middle of the street at night in my quiet neighborhood?
But those are always great questions to ask, by the way. I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
You know, why really? What's really going
right
on here? But then at the end, you have a chance to learn from it. And?
Well, the book ends on a sort of unresolved question. It ends with me holding my phone, considering whether to call the police. And I don't say what I do. I will say this. It never occurred to me before I immersed myself in reporting on this to hesitate to call the police, that there could be some possible downside. It always seemed to me like the prudent thing to do if you're at all worried is to call the cops, right?
Yeah.
Reporting this book, talking to the people I talked to, made me think twice about that. Are the police the best people to enter into situations of conflict, disorder, argumentation? Should we send people who are trained to use their gun to defend themselves to be the first line of defense if, say, there's a person suffering from an episode of mental illness? Because that's what we do, but it's unclear we're matching the correct tools to the problem.
What else are you going to do?
I like to think about a thought experiment. Imagine a world in which on the south side of Chicago, there was one trauma counselor for every cop, and then one addiction counselor for every cop. Imagine a world in which those were people that you could call, that they were funded, that they existed as a kind of parallel adjunct system. You know, that doesn't exist, and it seems sort of almost crazy and utopian to imagine it, but there's no reason it couldn't.
You know, in the Seattle area, we're talking about a center where a place where instead of detention, young, low-level offenders, quote-unquote, misdemeanors, truancy, they get treatment instead of detention. Is that is that a spreading idea around America, or is that a Seattle bubble thing?
There's more and more of that. There's a lot of places are experimenting with things like vet courts, which are for veterans who are going through addiction or trauma, and there are drug courts that are sort of alternative means of essentially taking people whose offenses are related to their experience of addiction and channeling them rather through jail and the punishment system into a treatment system. That's happening around the country. And a lot of that has shown a lot of promise.
There is a Seattle movement against traditional policing, and it comes in different forms. Block the Bunker is a movement that got Seattle to press pause on a new police precinct. A protester said it would perpetuate a biased justice system at the expense of other stuff the city could be spending on. There's serious opposition to a new youth detention center, among other things. Do you think that our city, that a city can be immune from the national trends?
I don't think it can be immune, but I do think that it is important to recognize the degree to which policing and criminal justice are a local phenomenon. They're built from the ground up as opposed to top down. And there's a tendency to kind of over-federalize the debate about this. When we talk about the crime bill or we talk about Barack Obama and federal nonviolent drug offenders, those are tiny slivers of the issue. Most of what's happening is happening at the local level. It's happening because of local elected city council members, mayors, local appointed police chiefs, local elected prosecutors, frontline prosecutors who are hired by that local elected prosecutor. That is where most of the action is, in fact. And I think in some ways that's really promising and encouraging, because it means that, yes, at local levels, you can buck national trends because those folks are ultimately answering to their local constituents.
Do you include the war on drugs in this? This county is going to open some places where you can bring your own heroin, for example, and get a clean needle and a trained staff member to supervise your injection and encourage you to get addiction treatment. And the opponents of this say, so we're telling our citizens, our kids, that heroin is officially not a great idea, but an okay and acceptable idea.
Yeah, I think the debate on this is really a compelling one, because I don't think that the answer is clear. I mean, from a policy perspective, I think the answer is clear, is that safe treatment and sort of harm reduction is the way to go. But I totally understand the argument made on the other side. And that argument relates to precisely what I was discussing before, which is that there's a sense in which what we're talking about is a social order. What social order we want to have, what kind of messages we want to have about what kind of society we are. And the idea that you would sort of send a signal in some official capacity that you know, heroin addiction is fine, that's okay. I get why people are resistant to that.
Another local issue I want to bounce off you. How does enforcing immigration rules fit in? Seattle is now suing the Trump administration for threatening to pull funding from so-called sanctuary cities. The Seattle claim is that federal government can't order local police to do anything or coerce action by threatening to withhold money. What's your take on all this?
So there's a really interesting legal argument that's going to play itself out in the courts about the degree of coercive ability the federal government has. There's actually a fascinating precedent in the Medicaid expansion, which came before the Supreme Court. And in the decision originally that upheld the ACA, there was the other decision which knocked down the penalties for Medicaid expansion, which if you didn't expand Medicaid under the ACA, you got all your Medicaid money taken away.
Yeah.
The court said, well, that's way, way too punitive. That's a sort of violation of the state's sort of rights to self-determination. There's a parallel argument being made by all sorts of cities, Seattle, New York, where I live, among them. That's going to play out in the courts. In terms of it as an approach to policing, I think it's entirely backwards for the reasons that none other than Rudy Giuliani spelled out in the 1990s when he was the mayor of New York and having this fight with the federal government, where they were discussing this at the federal level, which is police, in particularly in areas that have large populations of undocumented folks, need to have a level of trust with the community that they can talk to them, that they can call them, in order for them to play their role to provide public safety. We've seen even stories, I mean, shocking stories of, in one case, a woman being grabbed by ICE outside a domestic violence court hearing in which it is suspected that the person that called ICE was her accused abuser. If you start going down a road in which local police are viewed by not just undocumented folks, but everyone adjacent to them, family members, friends, coworkers, as enforcers of federal immigration law, you are going to lose the ability to provide public safety in any meaningful sense to huge swaths of your population.
This is KUOW Seattle, but if you think you've tuned in somehow to MSNBC, you're sort of right for now. The book is A Colony in a Nation, and Chris Hayes is the author with MSNBC. And I just want to talk a little about partisanship, because just this week, Ted Koppel famously told Sean Hannity he's hurting America with his polarization, basically. We think of, most of us, Fox on the right, MSNBC on the left. Is your network polarizing America too?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, first of all, I would say the network has actually moved in a direction, away from the sort of self-avowed identity it had before at a network level. And you can see that in programming changes.
Have you ever polarized this nation, Chris?
Right. Hayes? I mean, so there's a few things to unpack in that, right? So first is polarization bad, right? You can make the argument, people made the argument, that when Martin Luther King brought the civil rights movement to Chicago, he polarized Chicago. In fact, if you read the letter from the white clergy members who write to Martin Luther King in Birmingham, Alabama, that is the predicate for the response, that is the famous letter from the Birmingham jail, what they say to him is, you are essentially polarizing the people here. It's not helpful. Okay?
You're dividing us.
Yeah, that's right. So at one level, is polarization in and of itself a negative feature, right? That any kind of social change, conflict, politics is conflict at a certain level. And it's unclear to me that, like, you can just say it's polarizing and that exists as its own self-evidently bad thing, A. B, there is a broader phenomenon of polarization that I think is really dangerous. And that's a sort of increasing epistemic bubbles that people sink into. This lack of shared consensus fact, and a kind of tribal mentality that, I should be very clear and honest, isn't just the weakness of the other side, right?
Oh, humans right. are tribal.
Humans are tribal. Confirmation bias is so real, and all of us have it.
That's how the meat in our skulls works.
That's exactly right. So, and I do think there's something really troubling about the way in which it's harder and harder to talk to each other across these divides. So my approach to my work, and I can really only speak for myself, is I'm fairly clear and transparent about where I'm coming from. I also work really hard, and the rest of my staff works really hard, to embody basic journalistic principles of clarity, rigor, precision, double-checking facts, not getting out ahead of the facts, openness to new facts, fairness and charitability extended towards arguments that you wouldn't necessarily think are correct at first blanch, right? Because they're coming from someone who you don't share the same worldview with. And I think there's a way to engage yourself that's open and curious and still has a point of view that doesn't necessarily cultivate the worst instincts of the kind of tribalism that I think is deleterious.
And are you saying what's true for a TV network is true for us individually? Is it okay to embrace your partisanship and your bubble and your Facebook curated Facebook feed and your biases and then just be honest about it and get at it?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't feel like I should tell citizens what to do. I mean, it's a tough thing to say, right? Because at some level, like, the most active citizens are probably going to be the most, like, polarized. But is that a bad thing? Like, is it a bad thing that, like, oh, yes, the people that were mobilizing to try to close Guantanamo, like, they were really closed-minded to the arguments for why Guantanamo is great. It's like, at some level, small committed groups of citizens that have really thick ideological commitments are the people that make social change. And I'm not going to tell anyone to give whatever they are, to give those up. Here's the one thing I will say. I do think it is important to not hate your fellow citizens. I think you should try to reserve your contempt for people that have power. And this is, I think, a really dangerous thing we see happening, which is the idea.
Some people think it's dangerous to have contempt for our leaders.
You know, I think you to be suspicious of those in power, to be angry if you feel they've done wrong, and to communicate that in appropriate and nonviolent ways is part of our democratic birthright. What I think is dangerous is to view your fellow citizens as the enemy, to allow those sort of tribal walls to build up such that you dismiss huge swaths of your fellow Americans. Because I do think that actually, that's a deeper sort of sociological phenomenon that's happening. And I think that's worrisome.
Finally, the book is A Colony in a Nation from MSNBC host Chris Hayes. It's not a sunny book. It mashes the weather in Seattle that we've been seeing for months. So I want to end on any hopeful signs, unless you think that's just fatuous. I assume
no, I don't think it's fatuous. In fact, I've been touring around the country for the last week and a half, and what I keep saying to people is, I think in many ways the last 65 days have been remarkable in the way that they have precipitated a rebirth of American civil society. All kinds of institutions that are the institutions outside the government, particularly outside the elected government, from the courts to citizens exercising the freedom to assembly and petition their government, to the fourth estate and the media. I think what we've been reminded of is that, you know, what keeps a liberal democracy and an open society liberal and open fundamentally is the people and civil society operating to reinforce those norms of openness. And I think we've seen a tremendous flowering of that in the last 2 months that I find really encouraging.
Most encouraging thing? Can you pick out one example?
I was in Brooklyn on the Saturday night after the first executive order banning travelers from majority Muslim countries was signed. And I was at the court because there was a challenge from the ACLU to that order. That would be,
you know, our state was a big part of challenging that order early on.
Of course. And in fact, I've interviewed your attorney general and your solicitor general on my show. And but the first place that it got blocked was in the Eastern District. It was in Brooklyn. And I was there that night with about 1,000 people outside protesting. And, you know, that moment to me, because I think that executive order was poorly drafted. I think it did violate the Constitution and due process particularly. And that moment, I just thought to myself, wow, well, look at this. 1,000 people on a Saturday night are outside a federal courthouse. There's a bunch of people inside who are fighting this law in legal ways. There's a federal appointed judge who's saying what I think is almost facially evident, which is that this is a sloppily drafted piece of executive order. And that moment to me was just an incredibly encouraging moment about the sort of vibrancy of American civil society.
Chris Hayes, MSNBC host and author most recently of A Colony in a Nation. It's been great talking with you, Chris. Thanks for this.
Thank you.